I'm Wendy Garrett. Thank you for tuning in. I appreciate your time. There are so many things going on right now in our world, all across the board, that it's hard to narrow the focus. However, when you are absolutely crazy curious about things that are that involve consciousness and our own abilities to expand our awareness, telepathy, you know, the whole nine yards, when you are curious about something, everything else fades into the background. And I've always been curious from the first time I heard Ingo Swann on Art Bell years ago about what abilities we have that we have not yet really fully explored or tapped into. And his legacy is that there's a wonderful cache of information, content, volumes, stuff in a vault, kind of like, you know, the end of the film when you see Raiders of the Lost Ark and it's stored somewhere in that big Smithsonian complex. Ingo Swann, picture that at the library. At the, I don't know if it's the library now. Okay, well, we'll have Blin Oliveri, who's in charge of all of this. Tell me exactly what it is. Now, the background is Blin is the caretaker. She's the overseer. She's the head person. If you want to find out about Ingo's stuff, to contact. Okay, Blin, now you explain it better than me.
Thank you Wendy, for having me on your show.
Sure.
So my name is Blin Oliveri, and I'm head of special collections at the University of West Georgia in this tiny town of Carrollton, which is west of Atlanta, about an hour. And we have these massive parapsychology collections, including really, I think, on par as being a national holder of parapsychology collections and probably the largest in the United States for sure.
When you have that
including,
collection,
yes.
I was going to say, who all's in it?
We have the papers and book collection of Bill Roll, William G. Roll, who was a frequent guest on Unsolved Mysteries. And he, part of his research focused on poltergeists. We have a massive collection of about 1,600 volumes of rare parapsychology books called the Hooks Books Collection. We have some materials from the Psychical Research Foundation. We have Ingo Swann's papers, Stanley Krippner's papers, and more are coming. And so our parapsychology collections encompass not only rare book, rare printed materials, but also these original papers that were coming out of organizations and individuals.
Now, Stanley Krippner, I've got an interview with him coming up. I've read his stuff for years. He's always been, he's done a fabulous amount of research. The one I'm talking to him about coming up will be Rolling Thunder. And again, that's something I have been curious about. I grew up in an area in Topeka, Kansas, where the Menningers were operating at one point, doing all sorts of research with people who had incredible paranormal abilities and studies. And Ingo Swann went there at one point and was in, I guess, the copper room, which if you're familiar with that, it enhances that PSI ability. And from what I heard when I interviewed Sandra Martin, his literary agent, she said that it really expanded his abilities so much so that it became really, it interfered with his life. Did you hear anything about that at all?
I don't know that story. And I think as we talk about, you know, sort of natural skills, inherent gifts versus how do you develop, how do you learn and train? I think that will come out in our conversation. That was sort of a question about very much on Ingo's mind of, and he really devoted his whole career in effect to it is, can someone learn remote viewing? Can you learn it? Or are psychic abilities inherent? It's just a natural gift. You can't, you know, you can't augment them, or you could augment them. But that line between gift and developed, trained ability, I think is really interesting.
Part of it, and I do want to mention that I've got the book that at one point I understood that some of his materials would be available free at no cost online, and there was a way to access them. And at that point, this was available, the book, the entire book, Penetration. So I immediately downloaded it and read some of the stuff that you're talking about in terms of what his philosophy toward ESP and telepathy is. It's great. We have it. But the problem is it on demand. And a lot of the military applications that they would like to use it for, which he got into and spent several years being a part of that program, the CIA Psychic Spies Program, they were trying to see how much of this could be done on demand. And he said that's where it got really sticky, because there were other factors involved that created a complication. And, you know, you crossed wires, basically. But that's what I think is fascinating with the content, the archives that you have, that in his writings and his, papers, there's a lot of work that he wanted people to have access to.
Absolutely. And so, Wendy, I think what you were referencing was the website Superpowers of the Human Biomind. And that website, and that had nothing to do with us here at the University of West Georgia, but at some point that was is no longer a viable website. And there is a separate website for Ingo Swann, which is ingoswann.com. We do have the entire corpus of Ingo's published writings and, of course, manuscripts, as well as extensive files on all aspects of Ingo's life. There's so much. Ingo was such a reflective, contemplative person that in his papers, you can see him constantly grappling with questions. And I think that is enormously appealing about Ingo, is that he was curious and he was kind. And so people would write to him. We have extensive correspondence files, and that people would write to him, talking about, out-of-body experiences or something unusual that they experienced, or even trying to connect with him in some other way. He would write back these very kind letters. People would send him, unsolicited manuscripts, and Ingo would read them and respond in depth.
That's fabulous. Because as I mentioned that as we were starting, when you have this insatiable curiosity about this kind of content, and you finally get a working mind, somebody who is considered an authority, and to get their attention and to have them respond, that doesn't always happen. Sometimes it's like, it goes into the slush pile of thousands of other inquiries that they just, they're overwhelmed. It sounds like he took the time to make a connection and to, in some way, shape, or form, mentor.
Exactly. And I think that Ingo felt his own sort of support network pretty keenly. When he started out and kind of investigating sort of the boundaries of his guild, he had just a huge social circle with Zelda Supley and Dr. Gertrude Schmeidler. And he eventually, hooked up with Russell Targ and Dr. Puthoff. And Ingo's network of social interconnections just was huge.
Now, when you have all these archives and files, and you mentioned several, individuals, what is your focus? Do you fill in the blanks? Do you make sure everything's updated? I'm looking at the website, and it's been updated since I was on there last, maybe a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like it's interactive, and I really appreciate that, because it's like, oh my gosh, there's more information. Yay! So is that you?
Yes, that's us. So we have about 121 boxes of Ingo's papers. So that's a pretty good size collection. Just to give you a marker, we also have very huge political collections here, including the papers of U.S. Congress people. And so Newt Gingrich's papers, for example, are 3,441 boxes.
Oh, my. Okay, well, that kind of separates the politician from the psychic, okay? There's a lot of language there.
So 121 boxes, though, is still sizable, not compared to U.S. congressional collections, but in the world of special collections and archives, it's a good size. I think one of the things that's so telling about Ingo's papers is that they came to us very meticulously arranged. And I visited Ingo's home on the Bowery after he passed on, and I saw some of the materials were in situ. Some had already been boxed up and put in a storage in preparation for being sent down here. But Ingo was a meticulous records keeper. And that, I mean, if all your listeners out there, Wendy, would be so meticulous, we could really build quite a powerhouse of documentation of American life. So Ingo was very deliberate. I mean, he had all of these files that he collected and augmented in the process of publishing the book Cosmic Art. He had enormous files dating to his time at SRI, at Stanford Research Institute. Mm-hmm. Files, he did all of his training binders from his students and from himself, alphabetical correspondence files, chronological files, manuscript drafts, research files, which include topical files. So it's quite extensive.
Again, if you're listening, we're talking with Lynn Oliveri, and she is basically in charge, the head of special collections at Ingram Library, and this is at the University of West Georgia. So it, not just Ingo stuff, but a lot of other fantastic paranormal research. And if we visit, is this open to the public? We could just go in and pick our favorite room and camp?
Collections is a little different because we hold incredibly rare, scarce, and valuable materials.
Uh-oh.
And so
okay.
Our process is a little different in that we usually make appointments with researchers. They come in. Researchers are often here, especially for our, we've had a lot of academic scholars using Ingo's papers, mm-hmm. and as well as other collections. And researchers come in and they're here for 3 to 5 days. Requesting boxes and we're serving them up in our reading room. So you can't check them out. You can't go back. I'm happy to show people the storage area where we store our materials because that's an interesting environment. But we actually have quite a red carpet approach to people. We really care and nurture our researchers while they're here.
Yeah, and I'm betting they have to wash their hands frequently. Okay, no fingerprints, no
right.
Deteriorate the stuff, quit it, no, don't breathe.
But no fight gloves. That's a totally lie.
Okay.
Except for unsleeved photographs.
So are they allowed to take pictures?
Yes, they are, absolutely. And really a lot of people choose to bring in like their cell phones or some, smaller device take digital images kind of in lieu of what we used to supply or our photocopies.
I was just thinking the shoe cam, you know? Okay, here's the psychic shoe cam. We'll put that, the little
right.
James. Okay, there. Okay, got it, quick. You know, there's so much going on with this that when you're listening, I wanted to just give a little background because the content on this website is there's a lot of depth to it. One of the books that he has, Purple Fables, Fables, the Quartet, there's a quote that says, the Sayer of Tales says, I can't stay. There are places to go and things to see. But your own mind's eyes can see their own tales if you let them, and see more than tales if you let them also, from the Purple Fables. And it's basically saying there's so much here within our own consciousness that we have yet to really, really access and become familiar with, that this is a life's work. And he has done this by giving people basically breadcrumbs. The book I talk about, Penetration, is on the site. Also, Reality Boxes, Secret Powers or Secrets of Power, The Great Apparitions of Mary. He evolved as he was working through this process and trying to get a grip on what it was he had access to. And as you know, as a student, a researcher, somebody who's curious, we have access to this wonderful gift that he's left behind. And I don't know. for you as a caretaker, you have a very special job. But for me, as somebody who is an explorer, an experiencer, this is a treasure trove.
Absolutely. And I think people who come in to use Ingo's papers, I mean, they feel it. There's a couple of things I want to address. Everything you say, Wendy, I could speak volumes to. But one of the important things about using special collections and using papers like Ingo Swann's papers is that you are entering into a dimensional dialogue. So when you're using archival collections like Ingo's papers, you become part of that conversation through time and space. And as you are processing this information and generating, sharing information about it with your friends and colleagues, or writing about it in some informal or formal way, you become part of that discourse. And that is so critically important. And it is dimensional in special collections, especially because you have the sensorial sort of experience of these original artifacts that were in Ingo's possession that he created. And there's just a wonderful dialogue that can happen. I want to step back and talk about, I guess, what Ingo's papers have sort of meant to me.
Oh, yes.
If you'll allow me, Wendy.
Absolutely.
Because I think one of the things that Ingo really touched on, as you mentioned in that quote from Purple Fables, is sort of, what are our human limitations? And what are the potentialities of humans? And Ingo was, of course, exploring these boundaries of, you know, psychokinesis, of, you know, affecting change, you know, on static objects, and in remote viewing, and his planetary explorations. And, you know, humans, I think, have a much greater capacity than is explored during the lifetime. I mean, scientific reports indicate, you know, that we're only using a small, you know, proportion of our overall brain capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, Ingo really has inspired me to dare to do more. And to be a bigger person and to do more. I mean, and I think what is impressive about Ingo is he lived it. He was such an accomplished, productive artist and writer and remote viewer and friend and family member. You know, he lived it. He did it all. I mean, I think he was a highly successful person in that he kept pushing at the boundaries of what he could do and what he believed humans were capable of. And so he ended up living really as a fully realized person. And that is incredibly inspirational.
I think part of it, when you're, you know, when I hear you talking about that, for you just, you know, getting a research collection, it has to be like a kid in a candy store when something new comes in.
Oh, yes, it is. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just, well, I mean, for part of our collections, you know, the person is deceased. So, you know, people talk, throw words out there like legacy of the person, la, la, la. And that seems very static to me because it really is sort of a continual dialogue with that spirit of that person. And so for me, working in special collections, I mean, I don't talk about this too often or too broadly, Wendy.
Yes.
You know, it is sort of like being in a dialogue with the dead, right?
Yes.
I mean, and some of the people who donate to special collections, their papers, they're living people. But it's really a unique opportunity. And there's a lot in our world that changes. But there's a lot about human nature and about society that is fairly constant. And I think there's so much to be learned.
Some of the stuff that came with Ingo Swann, and when you're talking about, for me, I do have impressions and I do connect sometimes with ghosts and that kind of stuff. So this isn't a foreign element. It's just that when it first starts happening, it takes a little while to sort things out and figure out where the impressions are coming from. And you do have people there no longer in the corporeal form, looking over your shoulder going, oh my gosh, what did you do with those boxes? This is the one I wanted on top. You know, oh, or this shouldn't be out in the public. This they're not ready for this yet. Mm-hmm. You've got a crew there looking over your shoulder, hoping that, you know, that for the most part, that their best interests have left something of value and of use. And with Ingo's stuff, when you look at the things that he did with his psychic abilities and being able to remote view other planets, other, you know, the moon, and say things about Jupiter that we weren't able to scientifically validate till 10 years later. And during the time he's going, oh, am I just nuts? Was I off base? Questioning his own abilities during that time and feeling, you know, a little insecure. And then when it gets validated, it's like slam dunk. I did something, you know, this is somebody who was an active, and he had high expectations. He held himself to higher standards. He didn't want to, you know, make any assessment that couldn't be corroborated in some fashion, because he was doing it for science, mm-hmm. too. You know, not mm-hmm. just for.
Yes.
So that's what his papers show.
Right, exactly. And we're coming up to Earth Day and becoming marches for science that are coming up this weekend. I don't know if there's one in St. Louis. I'm going to be participating in one in Atlanta. You know, I think you're very justifiable and correct in bringing up science as a really important component of Ingo's oeuvre. And of course, he was working at Stanford Research Institute, sort of cheek to jowl with the development of the internet, right?
Yeah.
And you know, his planetary explorations, having that sort of scientific application. As well as, you know, military applications and you know, some cases in missing persons. So, they're very much a science component to it. And how do we define science, right? And how is science used in society? I think are really important questions to ask.
Well, and part of this, though, is that we're still learning. This is a work in progress in the ways that we try to, attribute this to some kind of a scientific equation. And that can't, mm-hmm. we're still trying to define consciousness. It's difficult to figure out the math or, you know, some kind of a template to make this transition from what we cannot describe to something that is completely finite, and you know, there's dot the I's and cross the T's. We are still facing, I think, a huge chasm in that area that will resolve, but we're not there yet.
Exactly. And there's so much that we don't know about the human brain, and we talk about training versus, you know, innate gifts. You know, I mean, in people who experience out of body, you know, experiences very young, like Ingo did, or other people do. And even, you know, synesthesia, I mean, these sort of phenomenon, you know, happening in the brain, you know, do only certain people experience them because they have something different in their brain?
Yes.
Or, you know, what can be trained and learned? And it's such an interesting question. You know, and so about a year and a half ago, I had a bad elbow and my fingers in my left arm were numb. And during surgery, they discovered that I have an extra auxiliary muscle in my around my elbow that in cadaveric studies, like 0.5% of human population has these muscles, right? And that was sort of an interesting. I immediately thought of Ingo. It's like, okay, so I have this bizarre muscle that it, you know, are found in toads. I mean, what is lingering? What remains in our human body that we don't know about, that some people have and some people don't? And then you ask, you know, you wonder about evolution, and maybe it's not that growing up from sort of that primordial soup into our very evolved human state, but maybe it's something different. Maybe maybe evolution is sort of that peak attainment is not apotheosis of humankind in our current form. I mean, that's baloney, right? Because we're constantly evolving. And so how are we developing other aspects of ourselves?
Going to take a quick break, Lynn. Hold on. We're going to come back. We'll talk about that evolution thing. All right? So don't go away. If you're listening, we're evolving in the middle of that. Conscious living.
This is Maria Menounos coming to you with some urgent news impacting families across America. Studies reveal that 1 in 5 children in America are struggling with hunger. That's nearly 16 million children who may not know where they're getting their next meal or if it's even coming at all. These kids need help, and they need it now. But the good news is there's more than enough healthy food in this country to ensure that no one ever goes hungry again. And that's where the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks steps into the picture. They're out there every day collecting surplus food and helping to get it to children and families facing hunger. But they can't do it alone. Find out how you can help support Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
If a disaster struck right now, what would you and your family do first? Would you stay where you are or leave? What if you and your family were separated? Would your kids know what to do? How would you get in touch with them if your cell phone isn't working or the subways aren't running? Don't wait until a disaster strikes to figure it out. It's your responsibility to make a plan for you and your family ahead of time. To learn how, take our readiness challenge at nyc.gov/readynewyork or call 311 for information. In this online tool, you'll be faced with real-life challenges forcing you to make quick decisions at every turn to teach you the importance of being prepared for a disaster. Without a plan, it's like you're putting your family in a disaster. Visit nyc.gov/readynewyork or call 311 for information. A public service announcement brought to you by the New York City Office of Emergency Management and the Ad Council.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
So you see, son, good manners are important. Should I go through it again?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
Exactly. Always say please, thank you, you're welcome, and excuse me. Sit up straight, hold doors open, don't speak with your mouth full, keep your elbows off the table. Share your things, play nice, and generally treat others the way you'd like to be treated. Got it?
Got it.
And stop picking your nose.
Most parenting is hard to do in just 2 minutes. But 2 minutes twice a day, making sure they brush their teeth, is easier. And it could help save them from a lifetime of tooth pain. Visit 2min2x.org to find out more. A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ag Council.
Conscious Living. I'm Wendy, my guest, Lynn Oliveri. Head of Special Collections, Ingram Library, and she's got all sorts of stuff. Ingo Swann's materials, part of that. This is the University of West Georgia. Ingo Swann is what I'm interested in, but you have other people on, you know, that you have been collecting. This is the parapsychology, paranormal wing of this. What's the most fascinating when people come to visit you? What do they ask? And I know you've got the political thing. We're going to avoid that one, all right? It just doesn't have the depth. It doesn't have the potential. It's, you know, it's kind of stuck here on planet Earth. The
The Psi Factor takes us out to Jupiter and beyond. And inner depth, you know. So I wanted to, that's my, yeah, see, I'm totally biased. So with the parapsychology, what all in that, when people come there, what are they drawn to?
You know, I think Ingo Swann, I think, is such a huge figure in the paranormal field that his papers and his book collection are a huge attractant. So Ingo's book collection also came to us, and that includes really about 1,700 scarce parapsychology volumes as well, which joined our other rare and scarce parapsychology collections, both monographs and serials. So we really have quite an outstanding collection of books, you know, dating back from, and some I purchased, but, you know, dating back to 19th century England and France, you know, on the studies of hallucinations and human consciousness and phrenology, all the way up to books about Zen Buddhism, you know, mm-hmm. which were considered very fringy at the point. And then also, you know, on zombies, you know, really super scarce, very limited print run paperback books that were printed in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that through because of their print production of, you know, small print runs, but also the materials that they were printed on and how they were bound, very highly acidic paper, really bad blue binding, have just disintegrated. And people just, you know, kind of read them a few times, shared them around, got them back, threw them in the trash because they were no longer, they were not durable objects.
Yeah, they're fragile.
We have a whole selection of these rare paperbacks. So for your listeners in the audience, Wendy, they might want to rethink their paperback book collection if they have a small print run. You know, we're not talking Bantam books necessarily, but small press paperback could be valuable.
Okay. Yeah, you wouldn't think about that, about the durability. Okay, so going back to the reason I'm so fascinated and I'm thrilled with the fact that you have the Ingo Swann collection, there's stuff here in the book Penetration that was written in 1998, and he talks about beyond, because at this point he's really done some exploring inner and external, you know, the consciousness and how that manifests here in this physical plane, and he's getting beyond to what planetary intelligence, planetary consciousness, planetary group consciousness, basically, and then the extraterrestrial, or he would call it space intelligence, and saying that as we are working, we're doing some kind of a group think that we aren't even aware of that. And in the book, he actually is able to, he was contemporary because he was quoting and using some of the current people at the time. I'm trying to remember, Eldon Taylor is one of the ones that he's quoting in here, talking about how, and this has to do really with subliminal cueing and giving people messages that they may not be aware of. The reason I'm working with this one is because it actually fits into the time we're going on right now, where people are getting, they're getting somehow a subliminal message that makes them do or react in a way that they wouldn't overtly or be consciously aware of. And that's being done more now because of the fact that they know it's really effective. And that's in one of the, you know, one of the publications that he's got talking about. Those are the things that he discovered as he was working and exploring with these kinds of abilities. Does it, you know, what was telepathy? How is something transmitted? And how do we, you know, the problem with doing some of this stuff and reproducing it is that once somebody knows something about, either an operation, some kind of an intended outcome, then it basically taints the outcome. You have to be completely and totally uninformed, unaware, and not connected to anybody in the room who has this information. There was so much out there that he realized we aren't really acting as individuals. We are part of a larger thing. And I'm trying to condense this because it takes too much time to explain it, but hopefully it's halfway coherent. And that's what's happening now in a lot of ways with our politics, is that we are acting in a much greater, form than we realize when we each think, I'm doing this all by myself. But we are influenced constantly by the media and by what we read. And like you're saying, when you go and you engage this library, I bring back something of Ingo every time I read something that he has. I learn, I expand. And that is exhilarating in my view, to be able to expand by reading something that somebody has left that doesn't have everything all answered. It leaves open the potential for exploring and for learning and growing. And that's where we come back to evolving. So you've been with this and you said, you know, you really enjoyed his stuff. How do you see yourself evolving as a result of his work?
I think sort of, as I mentioned, sort of, using Ingo as an exemplar for self-realization and fulfillment. And there's just really that, what speaks most to me, I guess the hugest appeal about Ingo's papers for me is that concept of exploration and discovery. And my whole professional library career and my personal passions and pursuits in the wilderness, it's really about exploration and discovery and the ethics relating to that as well. There's huge ethical dimension to this. And so Ingo and some of the materials in his papers, you know, Harold Sherman, remote view sessions, and definitely some of Ingo's training sessions with his students have actually been to places where I have physically been. And so there's enormous resonance with me. Yes. I could tell you a story. I don't know if you want me to tell you a story about that. I'll give you a story. So in Ingo's papers, in some of his files on Harold Sherman, and Harold Sherman was, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with him, was a remote viewer who's based in the Midwest. And he was a practitioner. He wrote books. We have all of Harold Sherman's books as part of Ingo Swann's book collection. And in Ingo's papers, there's multiple files relating to Harold Sherman because they did many remote viewing sessions together, including the Jupiter remote viewing session in 1973 and Mercury in 1974 and Mars in 1975, et cetera, and Mars in 76 as well, and onwards. So Harold, in one of these files for Harold Sherman, it documents a remote viewing case that Harold Sherman worked on in Washington State, where I spent a big part of my adult time. And it was a case relating to a small private airplane disappearance. And the on the airplane was a really prominent Pacific Northwesterner called Wing Luke. They were traveling across the state, across the Cascade Mountains, plane disappears. And so Harold was contracted by the family, contacted by a family member to do a remote viewing to see if this plane could be located. And Harold, this is interesting if you think about the process of how people work. So Harold asked for a personal item of Wing Luke. And it happens that this family member, Wing Luke had given him a pair of shoes. Him. So he sent Harold Sherman like one of the shoes, and Harold used that as sort of this touchstone to remote view into this site.
Yeah.
And Sherman, in fact, did locate the location of the aircraft, which was in a very unusual sort of spot in that the plane was crossing the Cascades, and I don't recall the exact details, if it was engine failure or why this plane failed. But then the fuselage was behind a rock overledge just outside of Index, Washington, an area that I've climbed in. And so that was just so fascinating to read about how Herald worked in that particular case, to think about how remote viewing has these multiple applications, including, you know, sort of its finding of missing persons and solving, you know, mysteries. And just that connection, because I knew of Wing Luke, and there's now a Wing Luke Museum in Washington State, and I've been to that area myself, and it was like, what? I know all about this. I know all about this, but from a totally different side, from having read newspaper accounts of this accident and the death of Wing Luke. And I knew it from a whole different side in a whole different part of my life. And then here I am in Carrollton, Georgia, and boom, here this information is from a completely different perspective, from Harold Sherman's investigation and location of this aircraft. I just thought it was mind-blowing to me.
Yes.
Really fascinating. I want to touch it. Yeah, go ahead, Wendy.
No, that's fine. I was just going to say the shoe thing. It was a really a novel way of getting something that might resonate, because you're looking for, in a non-physical fashion, something that has that same essence, and giving him something that might be familiar in that tone, that there are really few words, frequency, that element, it would help him to kind of identify, okay, here's a similar essence, and this is what, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a different way of accessing information. And he gave you a template by saying, in that case, he needed the shoe, and the shoe made sense. And so, you know, that just learning from what you described, I'm like, oh wow, that's a really cool way to do it, to approach it. Okay, now we mm-hmm. were going to.
Yeah, there's so many methodologies, and that's what's really fascinating. You can see in Ingo's papers, the methodologies in the book collection. I mean, any practitioner of remote viewing can tell you that, you know, there's 100 different ways to do it, basically. You know, what are do you need some kind of touchstone, or do you not? Do you need a physical thing, or do you need some sort of mental cue? What's your environment like that can get you into this remote viewing headspace? You know,
yes.
It's really fascinating. Whole methodological point of view. What I'm really interested in what you said, Wendy, as well, is it's sort of that group thinking, group consciousness, and sort of that ecological dialogue that you also mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that really the parapsychology program here, so we have a very fascinating psychology department, which has its roots in humanistic psychology, which looks at the dimensions of human experience and humans as an animal that needs love and reinforcement and nurturing, that has broader connections aside from just looking at solely the pathos of being a human being. So mm-hmm. a more holistic view of humans. And so one of the roots of humanistic psychology is sort of that ecological connection between humans and our environment. And this is one of these connecting pieces for both our academic program and our psychology collections here, which also includes this huge humanistic psychology collection. So that's one of these connecting links, is sort of that ecological dialogue. And one of the graduate students who works for me, who's worked on Ingo's papers for 2 years, named Sally Hildreth, her research area is in fact this ecological dialogue. And she's not only looking at particularly the field of astrology as sort of a predictive tool, but astrology as a way of a human connecting with universal, our universe soul dialogue. And
okay.
That is something that what I have found, and Sally is just an incredible person. You'll hear her name many times in the future, I'm sure. But one of the things that I've really learned from her and from Ingo is really that, you know, how narrow our sights are as a human. And when we think about place, and place is one of these major drivers of Ingo's remote viewing work, right? So he was using longitude and latitude, you know, to remote view into places, right?
Yes.
On our
yes.
Earth surface. And then he had to change that device to get out to space because longitude and latitude wouldn't work out there.
Yeah.
But there is an expansive view of a sense of place that includes our entire universe as infinite, and that as humans, because of our limitations, we sort of put these boundaries, these geographic sort of boundaries on what we can understand, you know, on our own planetary surface, like we're looking horizontally, we're looking down. And then, you know, and even looking up into the stars that, you know, oh, we can recognize constellations, we can recognize, you know, our local planets, but that as humans, that's sort of our boundary. That's what we know. If we think of the universe, we think of Mars, you know, we think of Neptune, and we think about the sun, you know, and so that we have potentially a much greater capacity to comprehend more about place and as humans, our sense of place.
I think that when Ingo gets into this, he goes into the consciousness aspect where he's not limited by the form. He's out of his body a lot of the time, and he's connecting, organically on some level with everything in his space. And so that's why I learned so much from reading some of his stuff and his perspectives. And, you know, there's some other stuff I picked up along the way. Ted Owens, who was called the PK Man, and he also mm-hmm. had the same sense of this Space Brothers, there's another extraterrestrial, and those are the language we're talking. We don't really know if they're physical or if it's another dimensional element, but it's something with another form of consciousness that we can connect to. And as we do that, whether it's through out-of-body experiences, whether it's through a higher heightened sense of consciousness, through meditation, there is that sense of real, and then we get information we did not in this form have access to. And it's mind-boggling when these things are beginning to become more in our society, acceptable to be talked about, and more tangible in forms of getting some kind of proof that, yes, I did experience this, and the near-death experiencers are bringing that into the equation. But Ingo was there first in many ways. See, that's why he's called, you know, the grandfather of remote viewing, or I don't think it's the godfather. Anyway, he gives people some kind of basis for this expanded awareness and says, it's natural. It's natural. It's a part of us. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Exactly. And this loops right back to sort of that group consciousness. That there is perhaps a level of consciousness that's out external to us that I don't know where it rests, right?
Yeah.
Sort of universal group consciousness that can be tapped into. And Wendy, when you were talking earlier about subliminal messages, and you know, I mean, we know the history of subliminal messages, like in marketing per se, but what it seemed to me is that you were kind of suggesting perhaps that like for-profit companies or nefarious forces of one sort or another could potentially introduce or inject manipulative things into this group consciousness.
Yes.
Is that what you were suggesting?
Yes, it's an imprint. It's a way of doing it, and it's very surreptitious. It doesn't have to be obvious. It's just a mention of a trigger word or a mention of a suggestion, and that's what it is. It's a suggestion, and it's extremely effective, in my opinion. So yes, that's what I was kind of alluding to, that things are happening below the surface. And if you're not really comfortable with your own perspective on things, then it's easy to get caught up in a group think that may take you in a different direction. That's how I view it, is you can get caught up in that crowd, that herd mentality, that, going along and not even knowing that you have been influenced because you weren't already, you didn't have a predisposition toward a certain kind of thought or belief system. And so you become vulnerable to whatever whichever way the wind's blowing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And one thing I'd say, it makes me think that there might be levels of group consciousness. And
yes.
I think that,
yes.
maybe the highest level of group consciousness would be some sort of some level of it.
Yeah. 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 They're just not into this.
Connectedness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, this isn't, it's like, okay, yeah, right. You guys are too wordy. Yeah, yeah, that just kind of rules out the non-essential, okay? Home, we're good.
Exactly.
We're good with that.
Exactly.
And I'm not there yet, okay? I'm working on, I love those moments. I have those own moments. But then this other stuff comes, it's just too fascinating. The drama is just, it's seductive. And so here we are talking about Ingo Swann. And that is, that's what I think that a lot of us are here doing, exploring and enjoying the potentials and the opportunities we have to get out of this little tiny mindset and into a bigger sense of connection to a greater reality. That's the way I put it anyway.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead, Wendy.
In the meantime, so when we're going to come visit you.
Yes, please do.
What room do we start with first? What collection? I know we focused on Ingo, but do you have a favorite place to go explore? And
well, if you come here to the University of West Georgia's Ingram Library for a special collections, we just have one reading room where we serve materials up, and it's really it's the researchers who drive the engine here of what are they interested in, and that sort of sets the parameters for what we bring out to start, and then they can say, oh, but this is leading me in another direction. I'd like to see this whole set of materials, and we'll bring them on out. So our role here is to collect, preserve, facilitate public access to these materials, and that's what we do.
Now, are each of your collections on different websites? Because I know ingoswann.com is the one. This is where all of his stuff is housed. Okay.
And that's not associated with us at all. So the website for us is really one of the key things is that you can is the finding aid to Ingo's papers, which is like a guide to the box contents of Ingo's papers, and it has a lot of other information there.
Okay. What's the website?
Okay, so, and I'm just locked out of my computer right now, but if you put in quotation marks in a search engine, Ingo Swann papers, you will come up with it.
Okay, I'm doing that right now.
And it's kind of a long URL, but if you put in a search engine, Ingo Swann papers in quotation marks, you will find our finding aid.
It's uwg.galileo.usg.edu. Yeah, it's a long one.
That's correct. Yep. That's correct.
But I got it. Okay. So yeah, so this is where you've got I've just discovered a whole new world. Goodness gracious. Yes. This is okay. Well, darn, we have to have another interview. Okay. These are all the people, My. Yes. Okay. There's the Zen stuff. I'm just, do you have Madame Blavatsky in there? I'm just curious.
You can find tons of stuff. We've had people come in because Ingo held the papers of a person named Dr. Raymond Piper. And in Dr. Raymond Piper corresponded with Jung, Carl Jung. So there's Jung correspondence in here. So we just had a researcher today and several over the past week, in fact, come in to read correspondence from Carl Jung.
So wow.
Of amazing, amazing things. And Ingo's papers and in our other collections.
Okay. Well, all right. Yeah. So if you're listening and you heard that, do the search. I'll post it on my website too, on the Wendy's Coffee House. And we've got to go. I've got to let you go. Lynn, I really appreciate your time. And if somebody's interested, they do need to call and make an appointment if they're going to go in person to set that up. But for the most part, if you get on this website, then you're going to find tons of information to keep you curious. Thank you for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Wendy. Thanks for having me on the show.
And as I said, I'll go ahead and post the link on the Wendy's Coffee House site and as much as we can about this with Swan. Fascinating. And it just keeps you exploring and expanding and evolving. Thank you. I appreciate your time. Think the best thoughts. See ya.